This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon. Welcome. I'm Genevieve Jacobs from 666 ABC Canberra, where I present the morning's program, and I'm delighted to be with you for this second in our series of lectures at the National Museum on the Old Masters' bark paintings. And this is quite a journey we're on through both the ideas and the physical realities of these extraordinary works. The exhibition has been really successful on a number of levels. Firstly, it's just a really good idea in the first place. The National Museum has an extensive body of works on bark that reflect all sorts of collecting priorities. There are works that would have been regarded as ethnographic when they were originally sourced from their makers, illustrations of culture that were later recognised for the art that they actually are. There are major works that go towards a profound understanding of culture and creativity. And in common with all artworks, there are multiple ways of both looking and seeing. And this is where we go today with Professor Howard Morphy towards understanding meaning in Yolngu bark painting. Howard's academic career covers territory that I find personally absolutely fascinating. He's Professor of Anthropology in the Research School of Humanities and the Arts at the ANU, and he's published widely on the anthropology of art, aesthetics, performance and related areas, understanding the cultural patterns and meaning in art and performance. And for this exhibition, that is a profoundly important approach because among a group of artists who are largely born before extensive European contact, culture is everything in a way we find almost impossible to grasp in this day and age. Culture permeates song and dance and marks on bark, but it weaves its way through language and the natural world and through the understanding of everything around these makers, the stars above them, the way the water moves in the sea, the little freshwater creeks trickling their way towards the ocean. And that understanding then permeates the work in ways that are far more complex than simple representation or decorative motifs. So the designs in these works come from the maker's own identity, a diverse library of visual references about moiety and skin and country, and they convey the essence of what the world is about at an almost cellular level, the energy that buzzes through it. So it's the sound of the earth, bees at work on the bush honey, wind moaning through the trees, roaring waves, the frogs talking about the coming wet, and the feel of flies and sand flicking on the skin, and the noonday glare of the sun and the pulsing purple sky waiting for the thunder to break. It's an extraordinary thing to conjure with, the comfort with which Yolngu live among multiple layers of coexisting reality. And I've often reflected on the art world's delight with the desert paintings of Emily Nangwari and the like, the power of their abstract forms. And when, of course, what's actually going on is 10 times more dense and more intricate than that. We are all visitors in this land. We can't be anything other. It'd be like walking into Chartres Cathedral with a hammer and some 4x2 and saying that we get the concept. So we're privileged indeed today to have another insight into the world of the Old Masters, the second in this series of three lectures that accompany the exhibition. Please welcome Professor Howard Morphy.
Well, thank you, Genevieve. That was such a wonderful introduction that I think I can just flick through the slides and get people to put their interpretation on the images as they come up. I am going to be talking about Eastern Arnhem Land, about the region from Yirrkala down to Blue Mud Bay. The exhibition covers a whole range of parts across Arnhem Land. But Luke Taylor's next lecture will be primarily on the art of Western Arnhem Land. So don't expect to see any X-ray art or any sorcery figures appearing, at least consciously. This is Mungarawi Yunupingu. It's a photograph by Margaret Tuckson. And Margaret Tuckson and Tony Tuckson and Skugel played a very important role in the reception and acknowledgement of the equality of Aboriginal art with other arts in Australia. These were the first paintings to enter consciously the collections of an art gallery, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, were collected in 1959, and Margaret suddenly saw Mungarawi Yunupingu, whose painting we will see later on, just staring at this large sheet of bark. And she suddenly said, good heavens, that's like any artist looking at a canvas, thinking before he paints. And the extraordinary thing, of course, is that she was absolutely right, because today, if you talk to Yolngu artists about their work, then they'll often say, I think before I paint. And you'll see in the series of images that we'll be looking at this incredible creative process that is involved and the diversity of works that are produced. This is the work that launches the exhibition. This is a work by Junmal, an artist from Milingimbi. And I'm beginning because almost inevitably, if Yolngu are talking about their world, about their life, about their art, about their relationships, about the destinations of their soul, they'll say, you must remember that there are two moieties, Dua and Yiricha. Now, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of kinship here, but the painting here is by Junmal. This is here his clan, a Dua moiety clan associated with two ancestral women, the Jankau sisters, who created a series of waterholes on their journeys across Arnhem Land. And you can imagine these are each waterholes in turn created by those women as they walked across the drying wetlands. And on the other side is the design from his mother's clan, the Yiricha moiety, and it's a design that's associated with wild honey and fire. So when I talk about Dua and Yiricha as we go through this, and I won't talk about it too much, you'll understand that we're talking about core features of the Yolngu universe. This is a painting of the Dua moiety by Munain. This is also associated with the Jankau sisters. Whereas in the previous painting, we saw this whole sequence of places where the women journeyed, in this place we're focusing down on one of them. And this circle here represents one of the places created by the Jankau sisters when they put their digging sticks into the ground. And it was a place where they collected oysters. And this pattern here represents the oysters on the rocks at this particular place. This is a very classic Yolngu painting that you could see as a body painting in a circumcision ceremony, or it could be painted on a person's coffin lid after they passed away, in order, in that case, to direct their soul to the spirit place they're connected to. This is one of the contexts in which exactly those kinds of paintings are produced. This was at a circumcision ceremony that I filmed some 6 years ago. And here we are having a painting that is connected with the Jankau sisters and their journey. Here's a more detailed version of it. And one of the things that I'd like to point out here is something that's to do with the technique and aesthetics of bark paintings and body paintings. The first step is to cover the surface with red ochre, which is, in a sense, putting the power and blood of the ancestral beings onto the surface that's being painted. And then the basic designs are drawn in yellow ochre, red, and then the final stage is this process of cross-hatching with a thin brush of human hair that creates this incredible effect of shimmering brilliance. And the Yolngu word for this is buryun. And when people are talking about it and developing analogies, because Yolngu will always create analogies to help outsiders understand, they'll say, well, it's like the sparkle that you get from running fresh water. And Narachin Memaru, when he came to Canberra as a creative arts fellow, had flown from Sydney with me. And he said, you know, it's really like, you know, we were looking out of the aeroplane and we saw all of those waterholes shining in the evening light, that sparkle that comes back to you. And in the context of Yolngu painting, though, this is, in a sense, the painting of spiritual power into the surface that then emanates from it. Here we have a bark painting that was one of the first bark paintings collected from Eastern Ireland land by the anthropologist Donald Thompson in the 1940s. And it's just to show, it's in Museum Victoria. The particular shape here is one that relates to the body of the person who's being painted. That goes up to the top of the thighs, those over the shoulder. And this particular painting here, that was done at that circumcision ceremony some 70 years after Thompson collected that painting, is actually a painting of the same place. And it's that place there, Baralcha. So this painting here represents an ancestral fish trap created by, in the middle here you can actually see a snake, which is a death adder. And it's the bones of the serpent, the ancestral serpent, that were put across the river mouth here that were transformed into a fish trap in ancestral times. So paintings relate to ancestral action in place. And in a sense, they are manifestations today of that ancestral being's power. And they're transportable manifestations that can be painted in different contexts, as body paintings for different purposes, but they also exist in other design forms in the shape of sand sculptures or things woven into sacred baskets. But we're looking at paintings today. And this is a painting which really, I suppose, captures in some ways what we mean by brilliant, shimmering brilliance. This is a painting of Birkuda, the wild honey ancestor of the Yiricha Moeti. The diamond pattern here will immediately attune any Yolngu to the fact that here we are looking at a Yiricha Moeti painting. You never get diamond patterns on Dua Moeti paintings, only on paintings associated with the Yiricha Moeti. And there's a density of meanings associated with this image here. I won't be going into all of them, but I will actually be tracing wild honey and fire as it goes to different clans of the same moiety. Wild honey and fire go together in this context. This is honey that grows in paper bark trees. And one of the meanings of the pattern here is the paper bark tree itself associated with that wild honey. This represents the core of the paper bark tree. This, though, at the same time, from a completely different perspective, represents the cells of the beehive and filled with honey, grubs, little sticks and pieces, and bees flying in and out, which you can see there. However, it also represents fire and the passage of fire, because this particular wild honey, Birkuda, is collected at the beginning of the dry season, just after the country is drying out. It's very, very dense in the area around paper bark swamps. So in order to get access to them, the land is burnt. And this represents the passage of fire. And you'll begin to see that as well as these designs being abstract and multivalent, in all sorts of contexts, meanings is built into them on the basis of their form. And in this particular case, the red here is the flames. The black is the black of the wood left behind after the fire has gone by. The white represents the smoke. And the red and white cross-hatching are the sparks that are coming out ahead of the fire. And fire is obviously something that is very present in Arnhem Land that needs to be managed. But it can also, at times, get out of control. And we'll see some of the ways in which fire gets out of control in ancestral times as we go on. This is a second painting of a different clan. The first one we looked at was a painting of wild honey associated with the Gupapwenu clan. This is wild honey from a place called Gangan in the centre of Arnhem Land. And this is another place where the wild honey ancestor went. I won't go into this in detail, but the meanings encoded in this case are very similar to the previous one, except here you can see this is the paper bark tree, that's the central core of the paper bark tree, and that's the entrance of the hive with the bees flying in and out. And you can imagine here, it's a paper bark forest with the floodwaters coming down in the wet season. It's the fire going by. It's the wild honeycomb. This shows the way in which wild honey, the journey of wild honey across Arnhem Land through different clans of the Yiricha moiety. This is that place there, which I showed you in the first painting, the fish trap. Here is Gangan. Here's the fire from Gangan moving to an adjacent territory associated with it, then moving down to a place called Yatikpa on Blue Mud Bay, and then fire moved, being carried by a crocodile that we can see here, right the way up to Caledon Bay. So we'll look at some paintings that relate to that journey in a minute. What happened? Now, let's go back. The fire moved from here when an ancestral being grabbed a burning brand and threw it ahead of him. And that burning brand travelled down to here. And was the fire that people there were using for cooking and various other kinds of things. One day, a man called Baru, human then in form, had a row with his wife, Damalingu, blue-tongued lizard. And he had a row over shellfish. She got very, very angry with him. He threw things at her. She set fire to the bark hut in which they were living. And the blazing bark hut on his back, he dived into the waters here. And as he dived into the waters, he changed his shape from human form to that of a crocodile. And here we can see the crocodile's tail, the ancestral crocodile's tail, the serrated edge of this dune here, going out into the bay. Behind me are two rock formations in the shapes of the hands of the crocodile. So the ancestral beings are transformed literally into shapes in the landscape. And just offshore here, we'll see in a minute, are great areas of seagrass, which looks red, waving beneath the surface of the water. It looks like flames. And more about that in a minute. But this is not a painting by an old master, but in a way by a young master. It's a print by Jambo Amarawili, but it's of that place. It's showing the crocodile there, in a sense, engulfed with the fire that was involved in his creation, but also surrounding the nests in which the eggs that produce future generations of crocodile, but are also spiritually important to the Madapa clan. So offshore there were these fields of seagrass. And here we can see a dugong, an ancestral dugong, and we can see people in boats hunting dugongs. We can see people here in the water. And what happened in this particular place was that in ancestral times, two ancestral beings harpooned a dugong, and the dugong, because the fire was perpetually burning beneath the sea there, dragged the boat and the men beneath the surface of the water where they were immolated, and their dead bodies and the remains of the boat ended up floating onto the shore. Then fire moved on in the form of the crocodile to Caledon Bay. And this is the fire at Caledon Bay. And you'll see again the diamond pattern associated with fire and in many places with wild honey and paper bark forests. Similar sets of meanings involved in that. The fire was brought here by the ancestral crocodile, and it burnt through the countryside. And it burnt through a ceremonial ground in which ancestral beings were performing what's called a Ngara ceremony. And in that ceremonial ground, again, the people were immolated. And in this painting by Mungarawi Yunapingu, who we saw looking at the bark earlier on. We can see the ceremonial ground here. We can see the people dancing in the ceremonial ground. We can see the impending or fire moving through. And in the case of each of these images, I could talk for sort of half an hour about every one of them, so I'm having to discipline myself and moving on so that we'll get to the end of this talk. But a very interesting thing about this shape here, this is the shape of the ceremonial ground. These at the bottom here are actually, in this context, sticks that are made to create a sort of hut in which people hide or reveal certain kinds of objects. But Mungrawi's country also included a place called Dupamar. And that place called Dupamar happened to be where the Australian government set up an ELDO tracking station, space tracking station. And it was one of the tracking stations that was set up for, I think, even the moon voyages. And this is remarkably, of course, ceremonial ground, like the shape of a spaceship. And Mungrawi did a whole series of paintings in which he just slightly modified this to refer to, in fact, a sort of contemporary use of his Gumach land in relation to the space race. Now, this looks like a completely abstract painting. Here, all of these kind of geometric designs. Already, people will be able to look at this and say, well, it's probably got something to do with the Yiricha moiety. It could well have something to do with fire or wild honey or something like that. And then you can read the description, and it says Ngara ceremony. Well, a Ngara ceremony is a ceremony where all the different groups associated with a particular ancestral track, like the wild honey, fire complex, come together to perform their own dances and to show their body paintings to each other. And this is what people look like when they're coming out of the Ngara ceremonial ground. So what you actually have, this is actually a combination of Dua moiety and Yiricha moiety designs associated with the Blue Mud Bay native title court case. And these are all come out of the sacred space, so it's perfectly all right to be sort of photographed. And here you can see the sets of diamond designs on that group of people in the centre. So what, in fact, Birikichi, the artist who did this, was doing, was actually, in a sense, conveying the nature of this sort of almost ecstatic performance that occurs when people come out of the closed ceremonial space, all with their body paintings, all dancing in different directions. Now, I'm going to show another series of paintings by that same artist, Birikichi. Birikichi, I think Genevieve said that some Yolngu were born before European colonisation. Well, effective European colonisation in Eastern Arnhem Land wasn't until around about 1935 when the first mission station was built. There was strong interaction with outsiders, a long history of relationships with people from Eastern Indonesia, from South Sulawesi. But Birikichi, the artist here, who I met towards the end of his life, from working out with his genealogies and so on and so forth, was probably born around 1878. So he was born some nearly 50 years before the mission station at Yirrkala was started. So we saw the previous painting of this extraordinary kind of apparent abstraction. We're going to see now paintings by him from two estates. One of those estates is at Gangan, which is inland, associated with fire, wild honey, an area of paper barks. This is where it is. And the other is a coastal area, associated in particular with stingrays. So, here, I think these are just absolutely extraordinary paintings. And again, the interplay between figuration and abstraction in Yolngu art really lies at the centre of it. And the way here that you can see the figure of the long-necked freshwater tortoise, Minella, beneath the surface of the water, because these are now the flood waters that are going between the paper bark trees. And you can see the way that the limbs of the tortoise are integrated within a design that is reminiscent of the diamond pattern that we see on either side. And in fact, one of the ancestral origins of the diamond pattern are all of the weeds that are at the bottom of the wet waters in the wet season that get attached to the freshwater tortoise's legs and things. And when you actually hunt them and pull them out of the water, you'll see these great long trailers of weed outside. So what's happening here? There's an evocation. I mean, I think this, to me, this painting really does evoke that sense of being in the shade, in a water hole, in the wet season, that is full of life, that's bubbling water, that full of just extraordinary. And here, what's this image in the centre? Well, this is actually a diver bird. You can see the wings there directing itself into the water to get fish. So again, this boundary between expression, abstraction, figuration. And these are adjacent water holes, but looking at the background pattern, Yiricha moiety. Looking at the background pattern, this is Dua moiety. When you get those kind of intersecting parallel lines there, never will you find it in a Yiricha moiety painting. And this is the neighbouring, if you like, stretch of that river there. And this is the ancestral snake Wittich, associated with one of the great foundation sort of myths of Northeast Arnhem Land, that of the Wargelack sisters. There was a wonderful exhibition at the National Gallery, must be nearly 20 years ago now, Painters of the Wargelack Sisters story. And this is by Mitinari. Now we're going to see quite a few paintings by Mitinari as we progress. So let me just, in a way, sort of summarise. Here, okay, that is the waterholes at Gangan. That's actually a painting by Yangarin. It's not in the collections here. But Birikidze's paintings were variants on that. You can see the long-necked freshwater tortoise. And that's the next-door Dua moiety area of land. So, in fact, all of these paintings create a mapping of place and the ancestral relationships between people and place. Let's move on. Okay, so I said Birikidze was, I mean, he was a great artist, but there are two areas of country associated with the Dalwangu clan. One is this area inland here. The other is at a place called Garapara on the saltwater side, and that's where these paintings of the stingray come from. Together with, I think it's a barracuda species. So what I'm interested now in these images for a little while is in the nature of a formal construction of art. I've been talking about the sort of, I suppose, the dialogue between figuration and abstraction. And looking at this painting, you can really see what I mean. There's exquisite artistry involved in Yolngu paintings. Birikidze did a whole series of variations on this theme. Which I think are quite wonderful. But it also shows, if you like, a particular construction that artists use all across Arnhem Land in creating a pattern out of figurative representations that almost reflects the pattern of geometry that lies behind the painting. So let's see how some other artists have done that. That's George Milperu, and those are flying foxes in the Arafura swamp. This is Narachin Memru, a sort of variation on the theme. These are a whole series of possums that are climbing up and down and in and out of a hollow tree, but at the same time they're on an ancestral journey and they're accompanied by a Yiricha moiety lightning snake. and here, Mitinari again. So you can see the structure of this painting. This painting represents actually steel axes because it alludes to communication and relationships with the Macassans. Absolutely magnificent. You can look at these paintings as really magnificent works of art. I was talking to a curator at the National Gallery just yesterday who said the extraordinary thing, this is an unbelievably wonderful painting, he said, and how does one know that this beautiful painting and the way that it's structured is not in part an accidental product of the artist's sort of, you know, eye and so on and so forth. Well, I suppose the only thing to do is that every single painting one looks at by Mitinari then had this accidental stroke of genius about it. And there is that sense that, in fact, when we're looking at artists cross-culturally, you'll know artists, there are enormous sort of synergies that one can go on. And one can have the kind of discussion that you can imagine artists anywhere having about their works and with each other. I remember talking to Narachin Maimaru, some of whose works we'll see in a minute, so I'm going to have to go on very quickly. And he was just sort of sitting there doing a painting, and he looked up without me asking any question. And he said, the thing about these paintings, you can be doing them for hour after hour after hour after hour, and you can imagine how long this cross-hatching takes. And he said, and then you look at it and you say, maybe it's going to end up a horrible mess. And then he said, and then suddenly it all comes together. I should think words like sort of it all comes together are part of sort of cross-cultural artist discourse wherever you are. So there is a kind of magical element in art. And this is indeed Narachin Maimaru. This is him when I first met him, painting a fairly sort of abstract painting in a wet season hut in Blue Mud Bay. This is the painting here. And I'm going to now, that's the painting we've seen earlier. I'll move on. This is the one of the oldest paintings in the exhibition, associated with the Mountford exhibition, I think in 1948. And this is an ancestral journey. Yolngu paintings can always be interpreted both as journeys and as maps of land. They can actually change in scale according to how you're interpreting them. And if we're talking about this is a journey of Oguaka Coel, who is now journeying very much to Canberra. And this is the track that he took from a place called Doinji to Jerakpi. He was accompanied by possums and by emu, which you can't see here. And he created and transformed the landscape through his action. I've written a whole book about this, so I won't talk anymore, or we won't get to the end. But this is the place that was his final destination. This is Jerakpi, and there's a beautiful lake here with piled high sand dunes that separate the lake from the sea. Now, that's going to be part of the story in a minute, those sand dunes, because they were associated with some ancestral women called Nyapililngu, who would climb up and down the sand dunes with their digging sticks, would catch and eat fish, and in the end invented a great ceremony for their brother's funeral. This is a painting by Narachin, and again, I'm just really showing this in part to sort of delight at the extraordinary sort of construction, the whimsy, the wit. There are elements of this that look almost like Escher-like. You can see how the swordfish becomes the tail of the stingray. Look at those particular elements going across there. Look like sort of abstract designs. Could be linked to the Yirrkala moiety because there's... Whoops! Gosh, how did that happen? That went very fast. Okay. And what's that shape there? We'll see in a minute. This is actually Narachin's mother's country. This is to do with an ancestral fight between a crocodile and a stingray, and the stingray jabbed his barb of his stingray into the crocodile's leg. You can see these transformed into the shape of two islands in Caledon Bay. This is a very complex painting. This is a painting of a story often told to children about Jiat. Jiat was a young boy who had an argument with his father and had a temper tantrum. The argument was, in fact, over fish. The boy caught a tiny little fish, and his father asked him to share it with him, and the boy said no. So his father went out in a boat and caught a whole boatload of fish. And the little boy said, "Can I have the fish?" And the father said, "No." And the boy had a terrible temper tantrum, jumping up and down and screaming and yelling. And gradually, feathers would start appearing in his legs and arms. And then eventually he took off into the sky. And you can see in just this little bit of the story here, that transformation in process. Okay? The rest of the story, again, there are many elements to it, but I am going to pick out on one of those elements. This boat here is a boat in which the body of an ancestral being was overturned out at sea, like the story of the turtle hunters. And in fact, you can see this rope here is the dugong hunters, is the rope associated with harpooning dugong. I'd like you to look at those images there. Those are two women. Those are ancestral women, Nyapililngu. Those are the women who walked up and down the sand dunes. Those are the women who created a sand sculpture in which they placed the remains of their brother whose body washed back on the shore after drowning. This is a variant on that theme. This has also got to do with the Jiat story. It's also got to go with people going out to sea. These are those two ancestral women you can see on either side of their digging stick. This shape here, bear that in mind, this elliptical shape, because that's the shape that they created. They created it, first of all, to bury the remains of fish left over after a meal. So it was a sort of active, like sort of returning to the land anything that was in excess. And they did that on the beach, and then maggots came and ate the fish remains, and then sand crabs came and ate the maggots, and then Kulawichpich, came and ate the sand crabs. And so it's a story about death and regeneration. Let's move on, because these are those two women. Okay, see the Nyapililngu? That's the digging stick in the middle that they used when walking up and down the hills. They used it to knock wild plums off the trees. They also used it to cut their heads in mourning when their dead brother's body came up on the beach. This is an ancestral sand sculpture called a Yingapungapu, and it was that shape, that ellipse, that they made as a shape to lay the body of their dead brother who was washed up on the shore. So they, in a sense, invented a sand sculpture that is used to contain the pollution associated with the dead body, but also where cleansing ceremonies were performed. And also it's actually then becomes a forum for great joy when at the end of funerals they try and bring the whole community together to have a sense of, commensality and looking forward into the future. Here's this sand sculpture, actually outside the shade where a deceased person was prepared for burial. But you can see that elliptical shape. That's the elliptical shape that we saw in that series of paintings, and it has many meanings. This is a painting collected by me in 1975 or something like that, such a long time ago. And that's got that elliptical shape. You can see here the fish remains in it. Here you can see the sand crab that would be eating the maggots that are consuming the remains of the fish. And there are those Gulawichpich birds who are going to then eat the sand crab. So what you have here is a whole series of things that are part of this metaphor. And up here you can see people dancing at a memorial ceremony around a Yingapungapu sand sculpture. So it's important to see that there's a sort of a tremendous relationship between ancestral dimensions, between ritual action in the present, that crosses over all sorts of different forms of aesthetic action. Here, that shows quite clearly the relationship between those particular shapes. And I'm going to show a couple of images of the ritual performance. So here, that's inside the sand sculpture, and what people are doing are doing a dance which imitates, first of all, them cooking the fish and then eating the fish, and then they'll bury the fish remains symbolically in the sand sculpture, and then, good heavens, a whole group of maggots crawls into the sand, crawling over the place where the fish remains were, leaving this particular pattern behind, which is an analogue for that process of, you know, I suppose the sort of decay of the fish, the journey of the maggots and so on and so forth, but is also, well, must remember that the story is about a beach. The first Yingapungapu were you know, shallow scoops in the beach where the fish remains. And in the beach, what happens? The tide comes in, the tide goes out. And one of the other themes of this ceremony is forgetting the sadness of the person who has died and passed away, wiping out those sad memories and renewing the world. So these are all ceremonies of renewal. Now, this is, in fact, a painting by Narachin. This is that sand crab on the beach. And I just want to draw attention to another, if you like, technique of Yolngu representation, which they have a word for called buyak, which means faintness or emergence, suddenly being able to see it. And you can see these are the these are the sand crabs. This is its movement in the sand. In fact, if you got rid of those two little eyes at the front, this would look like a geometric pattern. There's a sort of dialogue here between, if you like, figurative form and that tremendously expressive geometric form behind. And a lot of the, if you like, art that would be done in the context of body paintings and circumcision ceremonies and so on and so forth, actually, Narachin would say, it's just like that, except you wouldn't see the figures. So, in a sense, but the meaning is still there lying behind. And it's a technique used by all Yolngu artists. Here's another painting by Mitinari. And here, I mean, it takes a little while to actually see. These are the frogs, no problem. But these are the water lilies. These are the leaves of the water lilies. And the more you look at it, the more suddenly you can see the figurative current, and then it disappears. So if you didn't actually have the clues of the figurative representations, you may well look at this and see this as a dynamic, abstract form. And these are three paintings by Mitinari, showing the sort of diversity, ones that you've seen, the diversity of representational techniques that Yolngu artists deploy and have always deployed. And in a sense, what people mean when they say we have to think before we paint, it's because they actually can deploy their knowledge and skills as artists to produce anew time after time after time. And I've got a final series of images which are looking at the way in which Yolngu art interacts with the history of their relationships with the outside world. And I will zoom through these because we are out of time just about. These are Macassan prows. These are people from South Sulawesi. They're boiling tripang, beche de mer, sea slugs on the beach. All over Northeast Island Land, you can see the remains of these areas where pots were being boiled and tripang repaired. Yolngu had largely good relationships with Macassans. They exchanged names with Macassans. Macassan captains used to come to the same place each wet season. And Yolngu used to sail back to Makassar, which is why they have quite a good idea of the internal structure of the boats. These are paintings by Mao Lung, this one here, great Rio Tinto artist. And of course, the Macassans at this time, when this painting was done, had not been to Eastern Arnhem Land for something like 60 years. Because in 1907, it was one of the first occasions when the Australian government turned the boats back. From then on, the Macassans, who had been trading for some 300 years with the people of Eastern Arnhem Land, were no longer able to come. And you can imagine the impact that that would have suddenly overnight this occurred. No regard whatsoever, of course, of the rights of Yolngu people, who at that time were sort of still beyond the frontier, because the frontier was coming from south to north. Again, not an abstract representation, but a beautiful painting by Mao Lung of a series of creases from eastern Indonesia. This is Mungarao Yunupingu's representation for Ron Burnt, one of the crayon drawings that's at the moment at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, of the township of Makassar. And again, can't go into details of what these separate wards represent, but he said this is where the Aboriginal people were living and so on and so forth. You can see the things there. So again, people passed on knowledge through art, through performance, through dance, through ritual of that important part of their historical time. This is just Yelling by Port Bradshaw, showing the intense activity that the Macassans were involved with. Okay, what about images of the rest of Australia? Mao Lung was one of the artists whose paintings first graced the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and he came down for the opening of the exhibition. And when he returned to Yirrkala, he painted the lights over Sydney at night from the air. So Yolngu systems of representation can actually be used very much for new contexts. Yolngu can actually perform a ceremony almost at the drop of a hat if asked to for a particular... I mean, the great ceremony that was held for celebrating IATSIS's 50th anniversary was very much involving Yolngu dance performances. And is it the influence of Christianity here? Can we see all of these saints? This is a painting again by Birakiji, that wonderful artist. These are the ancestral beings, the foundation ancestral beings of the Yiritja moiety, sending out emissaries to different areas of land, bringing them the ancestral law. A very, very powerful painting. But Yolngu have been very much in dialogue with Christianity and with the Methodist Church. And in fact, an article that I wrote on that really was called Mutual Conversion, because there was absolutely no doubt that the missionaries were as converted as the Yolngu, and both happy to carry on with their own beliefs. And here is Narachin's painting of Australia, definitely a Yolngu and a Yiritja moiety taking over of Australia. Okay, that's all. Thanks. Okay.
Howard, thank you so much. That was just dazzling, absolutely wonderful. Now, we've got time for some questions and answers, and I think we have a couple of microphones. If you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get the microphone to you. Howard, I'd like to start with a question of my own. You've finished with Birakiji from the Yiritja moiety.
Yes.
Do the Yolngu recognise particular creative genius, or do they see these makers as people who are simply fulfilling a particular role?
No, they absolutely recognise that sort of genius, and that it can be in different capacities. So two very good examples of that. One is Obviously, circumcision ceremonies are a very important part of Yolngu ritual life, and they're, if you like, the sort of an early coming of age of your sons. And so people really want someone who is a renowned artist to paint. What you tend to find is that the artists who are commissioned to do paintings at a Yolngu ceremony, or asked to do, they're not commissioned, not paid for it, will be exactly among those artists that the sort of art world outside recognises. So that's one thing. The other thing is that there's no disrespect of a person if they can't paint. So one of the greatest Yolngu ceremonial and political leaders was a man called Dembalapu Munungor. Never ever did paintings, would be asked to authorise certain paintings and things like that. And so I asked him, he said, I can never hold a hairbrush without shaking too much. So, yeah.
I wonder too about this idea of the abstract, which is a concept that we have quite clearly in the West. Is that a notion that's got real currency among the Yolngu?
Yes, I think... If you see abstraction as a process, because I think there's a different... We for some unknown reason, in our use of the word abstract, in most senses, we actually do mean something that has a relationship to meaning. If you're writing an abstract of something, you're condensing it. So Yolngu see the geometric art forms as ways of condensing significant meanings that can then be expanded in all sorts of different kinds of ways. So it's very, very relevant. And the whole sort of process of abstraction, if you like, the way in which, figurative form can disappear into geometric form, that's a process of abstraction that would lie at the heart of, say, abstract expressionism or something like that in certain contexts. You know, it's the sort of thing that de Kooning would have done, in the sense, you know, making the women he was painting sort of almost disappear into the abstract sort of expressive form of a canvas that he...
Perhaps another comparison that occurs to me is fractals that compress an enormous amount of information into a very small shape and are capable of exploding if we have the key to that information.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Mm.
The role of metaphor was also something you touched on extensively, and it seemed to me that perhaps that was a crucial way into some kind of understanding of Yolngu, and I was fascinated by your description of a dance that mirrors but also at the same time effectively remakes the world.
I think that the whole sort of point of, if you like, this ancestral dimension, the Wanga, is that it is present and it is also future, and in a sense remaking it through ritual performance for different people and for different occasions is the way that you actually do renew it. And so it's a very dynamic society. I mean, people talk about the sort of dreaming as though it was something that was absolutely set in the past, but it's very much a sort of creative force that has a trajectory and that is not... you can't do anything. You have to work within certain kind of... if someone from the Duomoiti said, well, really, I think that the Jankau sisters' design ought to be a diamond one, people would just laugh at you because you're actually there not talking about a real world as they would understand it. But if you decide, as, say, Bundok Marika, a great Rirchingu artist, did when doing printmaking, she said, well, that particular design, I'm going to do it in blue and white now because I've got access to those colours, and that's reflecting, the landscape of this particular place at a particular time of the day, then that is perfectly acceptable. So people... are innovating.
It's a wonderful notion, the act of constant remaking of the world through your own participation in it. Do we have questions from the audience? Please do put up your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Up here. We'll just get the microphone up to you.
Thanks, Howard. That was fabulous. One of the things that really struck me is, and I think you reiterated it just now, but that sense in which the translation of motifs into that kind of abstracted form is actually what opens them up to multivalence, the sense in which the imagery becomes, at a sense, detached from a literal association and then can have those multiple associations. So that, I thought that was a really great way of putting it. But the other sort of little question that came to mind for me was that motif that you referred to as the ellipse in relation to the burial ceremony and renewal. Surely that's a vaginal reference?
What a cracking question.
Well, I mean, in a sense, there's an easy answer to that because, renewal does involve reproduction.
Exactly.
In the context of mortuary rituals, people are looking to spiritual continuity and to... and all of those particular images. Look, and when Yolngu bury people, they always bury them in something that can be considered to be a womb or a nest something like that. So definitely looking forward to that process.
Thanks.
Have we got other questions? We've got one down here. If we can get that. Oh, we've got a microphone coming to you from there. Thank you.
Many thanks indeed for a very stimulating lecture. How did you initially get into the interest in this area, and how long ago?
This is quite a yarn.
But I'll have to sort of make it quite brief. I became very interested in the anthropology of art and material culture at University College London. I was a master's student there. I actually wrote a theoretical master's student's thesis, and in those days, supervision wasn't that good, so I handed in my thesis, and they said, but we want some examples. It's no good having all this theory. So I went to the library of the Royal Anthropological Institute, and I found a book called The Toas of the Lake Eyre Tribe of Central Australia, published in the first volume of the Proceedings of the South Australian Museum. And it had 450 images of these toas with their meanings. And these toas are really beautiful objects. The South Australian Museum was extraordinary. They sent me photographs of them. They sent me documentation. So I actually then applied my theories to the analysis of those. And then I was working at the British Museum, but I wanted to really carry on doing field work and research and things like that. So I applied to the Australian National University for scholarships. There are not enough of them for overseas students these days. Then I came here and I was really sort of, in a way, wanted to study working with artists and in a community rather than working on a museum collection there. So that's what happened. And I was very lucky to...
We do probably have time for one or two further questions. Anyone else? I think you've probably all been absolutely stunned by the brilliance of what we've heard. It has been absolutely magnificent. I do want to draw to your attention the catalogue and the exhibition, which I hope you've all seen, but if you haven't, it's extraordinary. It's a journey into another country that is our own country, and it's a place that we all, I think, ought to visit. We've been enormously fortunate to have a guide today in Howard Morphy, and please join me in thanking him.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.